Accession number 4697, room number 1.
Mr. Steward, naval cameraman and photographers, real one. Could you tell us something of your early life and education?
Yes, I was born in at Hackney in the East End, and I went to Thomas Palmer's school, which was a sort of state-aided school. You had to pay, but the state paid a certain amount, and I stayed there until I was 16. And always had an interest in photography and films, and thought I'd like to go into the film business. And luckily enough, my grandfather knew somebody that worked at Elstree, who got me an introduction. And I went and had an interview, and after a couple of months, I got a call to start on The Yellow Mask, which was directed by Harry Lachman. It was Lupino Lane. Lots of half-naked girls, which I was rather embarrassed when I had to put the number board out amongst them.
What was your job at Elstree at this time?
Just a clapper boy.
And you were working for British International Pictures?
British, yes.
What did a clapper boy do?
Well, he had to put the number of the scene up on a slate and clapper, what they call the clappers, to synchronise the film. In fact, they still do it that way today, even though they've had in the past many electrical gadgets that to do away with the clappers, but they still come back to the old-fashioned clapper board. So the clapper board has reigned for about 50 years at least.
How long did this first film take you?
It took about 7 weeks, but we used to sort of work till 10 o'clock every night. No overtime payment was made, I mean. And you worked... Saturdays as well. I mean, always on Saturdays, and sometimes Sundays. And at Christmas, you either worked Christmas Day or Boxing Day. You didn't get the 2 days off.
What was the pay?
I got 25 shillings a week for the first picture, but I must have had the quickest promotion in the business, because on the second picture, I was made camera assistant, and my pay was raised to £2.10. Of the old money.
How did you manage to become an assistant cameraman?
I can't remember. Now, I think I got on quite well with the cameraman on The Yellow Mask. And the assistant that was on that, who I worked with, went on to another picture. And as things were in those days, it was a growing business. And, you know, I was lucky to get this break. And it was a French film made by a French director. I can't remember the name, but luckily we hardly had to do any follow focusing, which is the camera assistant's main job, and I managed to sort of get myself through this film.
It was possible at that time then, if your face fitted, to rise quite quickly.
Yes, oh yes.
What sort of cameras were being used?
Well, in those days they had the Bell Howell, which was... I mean, it was a very good camera, but the method of looking through it was so terribly old-fashioned. You had to keep sliding, to set the finder, you had to keep sliding the camera over and then sliding it back again. And because there was no follow focus on the finder, so you couldn't, I mean, later on the finder used to move when people moved, but in those days you had to sort of guess. But because you were in booths anyway... these sort of stuffy booths of the window at the front. And, you know, the camera movement was limited anyway, so... it was like living in another little home in the studio, because you had cups of tea and your toast and your two or three people in there watching the scene. It was very matey.
What sort of films were the staple of the studios when you were working?
Well, they used to do all sorts of films, but... I should think 50% of them were comedies, with people like Lupino Lane, Jean Gerard, Bobby Howes, and Leslie Fuller, who used to do the two reelers, directed mostly by Monty Banks, as far as I can remember. And then, of course, Hitchcock was there, but he didn't seem to get on with the people there, and he left and went to go on British, and then eventually, I mean, it's history, isn't it, to America.
Did you ever work with Hitchcock?
Yes, on the on Lord Campbell's Ladies, which he co-directed with Ben Levy. Well, Ben Levy was a good writer, but he never knew anything about making films. But for some reason, they made him a co-director.
How did you find Hitchcock's attitude to the film crew and the actors?
Oh, very, very good. Yeah, especially with the actors. You've got it all planned out before anyway. Incredible, really, because he never looked through the camera, but he knew, seemed to know exactly what was going on.
He had a reputation for being rather authoritarian in later years.
Yes, he was, yeah, especially with the actors. He didn't seem to... He just treated them more or less as puppets.
What was the attitude of directors generally to their camera crews and technical
staff?
Oh,
well, they always got on very well because most of the directors in those days were from the stage and had, you know, they had to rely on their camera crew to tell them what was what.
Some theatrical directors, like DuPont, had a reputation for being rather offhand.
Yes, well, DuPont had been a very successful director in Germany, and he came to England, and he didn't like, obviously didn't like getting up before lunch, because half the time he never appeared on the set until 2 or 3 in the afternoon. We'd been there since 8:30 in the morning. And consequently, he liked to work at night, and, you know, we'd finish about 2 o'clock in the morning and then all go home by car and have to be at the studio tomorrow next morning at 8:30, and he would still be late again. We didn't get paid overtime, so the company really couldn't care less. But that's how it was.
In 1936, you go to Warner Brothers.
Yes.
Why was that?
Well, somebody phoned me and said they wanted an operator at Warner Brothers. And as I'd been at BIP for 6 years, I thought, well, this is... You ought to make a change. You can't stay at one place. And they were doubling my money, which was also a good thing. And I went down to Warner Brothers and worked on many of the Max Miller films down there, which were very successful. And they had a better way of life down there. They used to start at 8:30 and finish at 6, which was wonderful for me because, you know, having worked at BIP, where you never knew when you're going to finish. Couldn't make arrangements to go out to a theatre or anything. It was terrible.
Warner Brothers, although independent, were an extension, of course, of the...
Yes, their films were the quota quickies. And the fellow in charge, Irving Asher, made these quickies. And we used to do one every 10 days. And finally, I think he wanted to produce something a bit better. And he left and went back to America.
Do you think the sort of regular hours and better working conditions were the American influence?
Yes, I think so. Because in America they had to pay overtime. Because they were organized very early on, I think, the American unions. And, you know, if you worked sort of, if you worked all night like we did, I mean, the overtime is enormous because it went into what they call golden hours. And the company weren't very keen on paying all that extra money.
How much were you earning by this?
I was earning about £15 a week then, which was very good money in those days.
You were a member of the ACT by this time?
Yes, yes, because I was number 13 ACT. Yeah, Arthur Graham was the first, who I think you interviewed some time ago, and I was number 13. But didn't help very much until about the wartime when they could easily get organised because people were away and so few people to work the cameras and they had to sort of knuckle under the ACT rules and regulations.
At this time, in the late 30s, there were a lot of foreign cameramen entering the market from Europe. Did this affect your job?
It did to a certain extent that they weren't going to bring the young English cameramen forward. But we got quite a few Americans, Hal Rossen, who was married to Jean Harlow for a short time, Phil Tenura, and Bob Martin, and many others whose names escape me at the moment. And of course, there was Otto Kanturek from Czechoslovakia, and many other German cameramen. I mean, they were thought to be the best in those days.
Did this cause resentment among the English cameramen?
I don't think so, because most of the English cameramen were quite young, and they thought that they might learn something from these experienced German and American cameramen.
Did you ever work on location?
Yes, yes. My first location was on a film called of Carmen, directed by Cecil Lewis, and we went to Spain, and I thoroughly enjoyed it because we went down to Spain on the blue train and first-class hotel and lots of sunshine and small. We had a unit of about 12 people, which you couldn't get away with today, but we had a marvellous time down there, very enjoyable.
Do you think this was one of the attractions of the job, the possibility that you would go to exotic places?
It was when you were younger, because you had no responsibilities, but I'm not all that keen on location today. I mean, I don't mind going, but not as keen as I was when I was starting in the business and had no responsibilities.
I believe you actually went to Timbuktu.
Yes, we did. Not many people have been there then. We went down to Algiers, and there was two special vans that we crossed the Sahara in, and we used to sort of travel about 20 hours a day, and we played cards most of the time, and had to settle up at the end of the picture, which I think I won £3 after about 6 weeks solid card playing.
What film was this for?
This was for Timbuktu with Henry Kendall and directed by Walter Summers. And we went quite down, I mean, across the Sahara, because some nice French hotels. But when we got down in the jungle, we just slept in huts, and there were spiders and mosquitoes and God knows what. And I don't really think I enjoyed that much, all that much anyway.
So conditions could be quite hard if the film was being shot in remote locales.
Yes, it was, because you see there were two cameramen and one assistant. Well, a crew of three. Well, today you'd have a crew of eight doing the same job. And we had to, when we finished working, we had to do tests, in a thermos flask to see that the film was coming out. And so the time you unloaded your film and done your tests, it was getting on for midnight every night.
You volunteer for the Royal Navy shortly after the outbreak of the war.
Yes.
What caused you to leave the film industry and volunteer for service?
We're all going to be called up, and I might as well go into something that I wanted to go into rather than be drafted into the army, which didn't have a film at the time I joined, was thinking of joining up. And I saw this advert for enginemen in the Daily Telegraph, and having had a bit of experience with yacht engines, I thought it might be my cup of tea. So I joined, and my first yacht was the Isis, which had diesel engines. I'd never seen a diesel engine in my life before, but the fellow who owned the Isis lent me a book, so I was able to swat up and keep it going for a year and a half.
You had no intention of trying to use your film experience?
No, because at that time the Naval didn't have a film unit. Otherwise, I would have liked to have joined at the very beginning.
So you answered the advertisement and, in fact, were joining the Royal Naval Patrol Service, which had just been set up. When you joined, did they test your experience in small boats?
No, because it was such a panic station. They just wanted to get you out and patrol up and down the channel to signal if there was going to be an invasion or not. We had some rockets on board, so if we thought we saw an invasion coming. We're supposed to let these rockets off. I don't know what's supposed to happen to us, but we didn't find out until after the war that the area we were patrolling between Portlandville and Nine Regis, where the water is very deep up to the shore, was one of the prime targets for the invasion. So, but we wouldn't probably have slept so well at night had we known, but we slept very well.
So you were given no preliminary training before you were sent into action?
No. I mean, the first day we had I got on this ISIS boat, which was down at the Southampton area, and it was raining, and we had a signal, expect air attack. And I thought, God, I've only been in the Navy a couple of days, and now they're sending me out with this old Hotchkiss gun to expect air attack, because the Hotchkiss gun never worked anyway, because it was always getting wet as it was mounted on the fore part of the yacht.
The ISIS was a 55-foot diesel yacht.
Yes, two diesel engines.
Which had been privately owned.
Yes.
These ships were being gathered where?
From all over the place. I mean, they had them... Anybody that had a decent-sized yacht was just commandeered, and they were used to do this patrolling business.
And you were allotted the ISIS?
Yes.
What condition was she in?
Oh, she was in fine condition when we had her. I should think down the end of the war she wasn't much good, because it took a battering. I mean, the ISIS had some lovely canvas fenders, which were fine for ordinary going up against the quayside. But, I mean, the first time we arrived at West Bay, they put the fenders over and all the cork came out, because they weren't made for that sort of wear.
What armament did you carry?
We had the one Hotchkiss gun, which was mounted on the foredeck, and then we had another Hotchkiss gun, which was mounted aft, and we had a box like a coffin that had two mines in, and the idea was to throw these two mines overboard with a cord in between, so that anybody chasing you would hit this cord and bring the two mines onto the boat and happily blow up the boat. But we never had to put it to practice anyway.
The Hotchkiss guns, what sort of vintage were they?
Well, I should think they were very old, because we had an instruction book, and on the front was a man with a hat on wearing feathers, so I should think they were must have been the 19th century.
And you say they hardly ever were?
No, well, we used to always clean them and oil them, but, I mean, you go out, and the first decent way would cover them, and even though they had canvas covers, and time it came to firing them, they would jam up after a couple of rounds.
Did you ever, in fact, use them?
We did use one once. We were doing some fishing, and we brought up a big conger eel, and we couldn't get it up, so we shot it. Otherwise, we didn't use it.
Did you ever visit the RN Patrol Service Central Depot at Lowestoft, HMS Europa?
Yes. But it was called, our part of it, but being an engine one, was called St. Duke's. And the only thing I remember about that was it was on the seashore, along the, and it had been a hospital before, and we were stationed there. And we'd stand out there in the winter on parade and the wind blowing. And we used to have prayers every morning. I used to watch the preacher. I mean, he'd never come out until everything was set. And he would stand in there in the warm, and he would come out and say his pieces and amen, and back he would go and leave us out there for an hour. I always remember that, watching this preacher behind the glass doors, waiting to come out to preach to us, and then dashing back again. It always I've always been a bit cynical about that.
Europa had been set up very quickly at Lowestoft at the beginning of the war.
Yes.
There had been no naval port division.
No, prior not to before.
War. Were conditions there a little ragged?
Well, they were. I mean, most of the. It was difficult to put you up. I mean, I slept the first time I was down at Lowestoft, I slept in a room with five other chaps, and in fact had to share a bed with somebody I never met before, which wasn't my way of thinking.
What was life like in Dorset?
Oh, Dorset was marvellous, because we were on these yachts and we had our own money to go and buy the vegetables, and I was sort of the one that had to go up to Bridport and buy all the food and got to know the girls and used to get the extra bits and butter and stuff. And it was just like a yachting holiday, really, eventually, because the Germans decided they weren't going to invade, and our duties became less and less until they faded us out.
What would be a weekly routine in the early days?
Well, 8 o'clock in the morning, you would pull up the flag, and even if you'd been out at night and had come in, say, at 6, as you might do, you had to pull up the flag at 8 o'clock. So we devised a method where we got some rope and put it through one of the portholes, and we would be able to pull up the flag from our beds, which was one way of getting over all the problem, getting up and going along the deck. But and then about we'd swab the decks down, and about 9 o'clock I would get on the bus and go up to Bridport to get the food and come back, and we used to take it in turns in cooking. Some of the food wasn't all that good because some of the fellows had no idea of cooking. But we did our best.
Where were you billeted?
We were billeted in the ship, you see. We lived on board on the yacht itself.
After the morning raising of flag ceremony and cooking, so yeah. When would the ship?
Well, then, you see, we would, depending on the tide, I mean, ideally we'd go out an hour before evening light. But if the tide was wrong, you'd have to go out and be anchored off, say, for 6 or 7 hours before you could start. And the boat would roll about and I'd be seasick, but that didn't happen very often because most of the time you could get back into West Bay.
What would be the longest period a patrol would be out?
Well, in the winter, you'd see you could say you'd go out at sort of, you might go out at 11 in the morning, anchor just off West Bay, and then start patrolling from 6 in the evening till 7 the next morning. It's terrible trying to keep awake all that time and looking out at nothing. So we devised an idea where we used to get some sleep ourselves, go in the wheelhouse and have sort of a couple on and two in the wheelhouse having a sleep. Otherwise impossible. You couldn't just stare out at them for 12 hours into the night, although you weren't supposed to by the naval regulations.
As the danger of invasion receded, did the frequency of patrols fall off?
Yes, it did. Instead of going out every other night, we'd go out every third or fourth night. And then we used to do a bit of fishing, and it was really quite enjoyable.
Did you ever participate in air sea rescue?
Yes, one day there was a bit of a dogfight, and we saw a parachute come down the sea, so we went off to see it, and it was a dead German in the water, and we pulled him on board, big fella called Muller, and he was covered and he was sick, sort of sick on board, but he died almost immediately, and we went through his pockets to see what he'd got, and all he got was about 20 French letters and a few French coins, so I don't know what he intended to do in England. But that was the only one we ever sort of came across.
I believe West Bay was attacked from the air on several occasions early in the war. Did you ever experience air attack?
I believe there was. We found a German engine. I don't know where it came from. But when we were there, it was never attacked. In fact, we knew the war was going on, really, and it was only, 20 miles, less than that, 20 miles from Portland Bill, where they had some heavy air attacks. But where we were, you never knew the war was on.
You mentioned fishing. Did you fish a great deal to supplement your ration?
Well, not only did it have something to do, but it was so boring, you know, patrolling. We used to put a line, a trot line down at night and bait it up with the mackerel that we'd caught earlier in the evening, and then we would find it in the morning. Sometimes it's difficult to find if it was rough sea, because although we used to take sightings from the shore, if the sea was rough, it was very difficult to find these things. But eventually we did find them. We'd pull the line in, and we'd have this enormous skate and conger eels. But nobody seemed to want to eat them. I was fed up with them. But we used to eat the skate. You seem to get fed up with skate if you have it every day. And that's it. There didn't seem to be any other fish there. We did once catch a bass, but that was some other fish had eaten half of it. So that wasn't much good.
But you didn't, in fact, find a ready market for these fish?
No. Nobody seemed to want to. Even the people ashore didn't want to. I see, because all the other boats were catching skate as well as us, because they were all at it.
The men in the patrol service, your fellow crewmen,
yeah,
what sort of backgrounds did they come from?
Well, the first skipper, because we're only on the ices at the beginning, there were only three in the crew. There was the skipper, Harry's name, well, he was a Cockney bargee. He knew how to handle a boat. Then he wanted something. He wanted a bigger boat, and he left. And we had a fellow whose father, when he'd been in the seed business down in Dorset, and he'd done a bit of yachting, and he came on board. And so it was, you know, quite a varied selection of. And some of the other skippers had been actual skippers on fishing boats up in Hull and Grimsby, so they knew how to handle boats. But we all got on very well together. We had a water polo team, used to polo the local girls. And generally, it was a good life.
You never found any tension between men who were professional handlers of small boats, trawlermen and bargees?
No,
and
not
the private
really.
Yachts.
No.
When does your time in the RM Patrol Service come to an end?
The patrol that we were on ceased in about 1942, I should think. And then I went back to Lowestoft, and finally I was sent to the AKS, the Army Kinemoga Service, which was stationed at Wembley.
How did that come about?
Well, I knew Thorold Dickinson, and he tried to get me into the army filming it for a long while, but because, I mean, in those times, I mean, any sort of letters took ages and ages to get answered, and it was about at least 18 months before he managed to get me into the army film unit. And the idea was that I would go into the army film unit and become an army officer. But although there were two other people at the same time that came with me from the Navy who'd been reconnaissance photographers, they stayed in the AKS, but I was sent back to the Naval Film Unit, which by that time had sort of decided they wanted to have a film unit of their own.
What were conditions like down at Wembley?
Well, they were very good. I think the Sergeant Major wondered what it was all about. All these people calling the officers Charlie and Fred and... I mean, he wasn't used to this. I mean, Carol Reed was down there, and I mean, he was a captain, and Freddie Young was a captain, and people were calling Carol, and Freddie, which rather flabbergasted this sergeant major.
Was there any noticeable army discipline, drill, etc.?
Well, yes, if it was... one thing that always struck me as being very funny, when they had early morning parade, if it was raining, they would have it in the hall at the Wembley Studios. And in the hall there was a glass chandelier, and the order was slope arms, avoiding the chandelier. which was, I thought, was really funny at the time.
But this was a fairly negligible discipline. It didn't interfere with the routine of filmmaking.
No, because it's difficult to have army discipline when you're involved in making films with everybody calling each other by their Christian names.
The AKS had been criticised early in the war for inefficiency and a lack of organisation. When you were there in 1942, was any of this very evident?
No, I thought they seemed to be getting on with whatever they were doing, much more than I found out later when I joined the Navy, as a matter of fact. Because they got Carol Lead as one of the directors, and Thol Dickerson was another one, which we certainly didn't get when we were in the Navy. I mean, Paddy Carstairs was the only one that, as far as I was concerned, had done anything in the film business. Maybe some of the others had done some documentaries, but as far as feature films, Paddy Carstairs was the only one.
What sort of films were you making for the AKS? Were they mainly propaganda or purely instructional films?
No, mostly instructional. The odd propaganda ones were made, but the film that seemed to be the one most people were interested in when I was there was a thing called The New Lot, which was an introduction for recruits coming into the army to show them the ropes, to show them what to do and what not to do. And this was directed by Carol Reed, and I think it was written by Peter Ustinov, who must be one of the untidiest soldiers ever, I think. But the film was quite successful, and you'd expect it to be with people with their background.